This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hey guys, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast. I'm glad you're back to see us. And today we have Jason Lambert, who actually runs his own podcast and is a construction law attorney in Florida. And the name of his podcast is Hammer and Gavel, where he, you know, talks about all construction related issues. Kind of a kindred spirit because he's got lots of experience in the construction world before he actually became attorney, which I think is essential to being a successful construction attorney. So, hey, welcome to the podcast, Jason. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm always happy to join and happy to, you know, talk about these different things that we're going to be talking about today. There's not a lot of information out there for contractors, so I think this is a great way to share it.
I agree. And today we're going to talk about the ugly truth about litigation that most other lawyers don't want you to know. I'm sure Jason can agree with me on this, is that it is hard to find an attorney who really has their client's best interests at heart, because as a general rule, those things are opposed, right? The attorney wants to bill to make money, which means the more tension and litigation they can create, the more the attorney will make, and recommending to resolve a dispute makes less money.
Yeah.
And so we're going to kind of dive into those issues today. But before we get there, Jason, tell me a little about yourself, where you started from, and how you ended up where you are now.
Sure. I grew up in the construction industry. My parents owned an electrical supply warehouse. And so I grew up working in that, working around electricians, and after college, worked for them for a little bit longer and decided I was tired of working with family. So I went and became a project manager for one of our clients or customers who was a big custom home builder. And so I was a project manager for them, and then a project manager for a big remodeling company down in Sarasota, which is a little further south of where I am now in Tampa. And all of this was sort of happening in that, you know, tremendous run up in construction from like 2004 to 2007. And so it was fantastic to be in construction at that time, especially in Florida. And then as everything started to, fall off the edge of a cliff, I rode that landslide all the way back down into law school. And part of that was because most of the work I was doing at that point in time, even as a project manager, was I was helping the company as I was with put together their contracts and even put together small development deals. So it just sort of fit with what I was already doing. And the bigger companies, you know, I looked at like Lennar or US Home at the time, and I was like, oh, I'll see if I can go work for one of them and do some of their development work. And they all wanted you to have a law degree. So I went to law school. And then came out on the other side, you know, and still working with the same people. So I've been representing contractors and subcontractors in Florida as an attorney now for almost another 10 years. And in anything that impacts their business, whether it's putting together contracts, representing them in litigation or other dispute resolution things, labor and employment issues, immigration issues, whatever comes up, whatever impacts the industry, I try to be a resource for them. So that's sort of the cliff notes of where I'm from and how I got to be here. So,
well, and I think like coming from the construction industry, whether it's a material supplier or a subcontractor or not, you have a different view, right? You view your client as a whole and, okay,
absolutely,
I'm helping them on this matter, but do they know the difference between a subcontractor and a contractor? And what are the ramifications if they don't? You know, what are some of the big things you wish you would have known when you were working in the family business that you now know, or that you've gone back and taught them or helped them run the business? I'm sure they're your biggest client by far.
If I represented family members, they might be, but I think the biggest things that I've worked with them on, and any of the people who I used to work with, because I have had companies that I've worked for in the past come back and use me, and, you know, I'd say the vast majority of that work has been, you know, helping them put together contracts that, you know, are just compliant. Florida's got a handful of things that by statute you have to have in your contracts. I know Texas has similar requirements for at least residential construction contracts. So, part of it is just that. And then the other part of it has been, other compliance issues. Again, Florida's got a pretty funky construction lien law that's very complicated and nuanced, and some parts of it are strict and some parts of it are not. And it's just helping them with that. And so I, the thing that I always say, and there's a post on my blog about it, about in Florida, the only industries that are more regulated than general contractors are doctors, and not just, you know, regular doctors, but surgeons. I mean, surgeons, the guy doing surgery on your brain is the only person in the state more regulated than you as a general contractor, if you just look at the volume of statutes and regulations. So, you know, you have to act as if you're in a heavily regulated industry, even if you don't realize it, even if it's just you, you know, doing handshake deals with people, all those statutes and everything still apply. So that's been the biggest thing that I've been able to work with people on, and that I've needed to work with people on, honestly.
Well, and they don't know going into the business, right? They have no idea that all these things are required, and neither did you when you were working there. And now that you know all this stuff, it's important to share.
Yeah.
So you have to be licensed to be a contractor in Florida? Because some states require, like Texas, you don't have to be licensed. You can come do whatever you need to do, but I don't know, what does Florida have?
Yeah, no, a very extensive licensing scheme. There's a whole statute, Chapter 49, that governs almost any type of contractor. Electrical contractors have their own separate special statute, but they're both governed by the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation. And Florida actually just opened up, just reduced some of the requirements for people, contractors who've been licensed out of state for at least 10 years. It's easier to now get a license in Florida than it used to be. And we've been helping a ton of people with that because it's a booming industry down here. We need more skilled workers coming down here, and so you're seeing people take advantage of it. But you know, even for somebody who's been a contractor for, you know, 10 years or more, there's a lot of hoops to jump through. And the penalties in Florida for not being properly licensed are, you know, your contract is unenforceable. Just so if you know, you sign a $250,000 contract for something and you get paid for it and something goes wrong at the end, they can demand all that money back, plus it's a crime. So now you're facing criminal charges too.
Damn. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty stringent. But then again, you know, I can understand why, because I deal with we have very few rules about that. Most of it happens after the work is already done, like in Texas. And I deal with a lot of homeowners that like have contractors come, get paid some of it, and then walk the rest. And these guys don't have anything to chase, and they come to me, what can I do? I mean, you can sue them, but I don't know if it's going to be collectible. So you probably just want to take your money and finish your project, because I don't have any teeth like that. So I can understand why that's required.
Right.
Okay. So what has been your experience in litigation, actually going to the courtroom or arbitration to have a dispute decided? I'm just curious what your general overall perception is, and then what it was like for your client.
I have a lot of experience in it. Overall, I think it's a terrible way to ultimately resolve disputes. For one of the reasons that you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, that you've got, in some cases, you have an attorney on the other side, you know, really driving the bus for their client and, you know, trying to run up fees, or, you know, maybe they've taken an absurd position with their client that they can't go back on. They have to continue litigating, otherwise they might have to admit they made a mistake or that they weren't right about something. And so I find it to be generally horrible in that regard. And for a lot of my clients, I mean, some of them come, you know, angry and they want to, you know, fight, and they don't care how much it costs. They want to win on principle, and that's fine. Principles are very expensive to have in litigation. So, you know, if they want to do that, that's fine. But most of them, honestly, by the time you've been in a lawsuit for, you know, 3 or 4 months, and they start to realize, you know, how dragged out the process is going to be, even if you're doing everything quickly, that it takes time to get hearings, it takes time for the other side to respond to things, or, you know, the other side, claims that the work was done incorrectly. And, you know, I've never met a client who felt they did anything, you know, that wasn't, you know, the most flawless work ever. So, you know, and they just can't understand, you know, how are they bringing this up? How can they even possibly say this? You know, they did that wrong. It's all of that. I mean, the other side can say and do whatever they want to do, and ultimately it's who's the judge going to believe or who's the jury going to believe. And I think that's a hard concept for a lot of people in the industry to understand, because they're used to dealing with a very concrete thing. You know, we've built a building. It's either there or it's not. It's standing or it's not. It's passed its inspection or it hasn't, it's painted or it's not. There's none of this like, well, there's all these gray areas in litigation and here's what I think they're trying to do. And, you know, I just think that's a different world for a lot of them to deal with on a regular basis.
And here's another thing in my experience, I don't know if it's the same there. How much construction law do your judges understand? And where do you start with them? And then on top of that, how often can you predict how they're going to rule and what's going to happen?
Oh, absolutely. No, that's a huge issue. There's one or two that I know from where how they practiced that they at least had some construction experience. But yeah, finding a judge who understands it, especially when you're dealing with, you know, in Florida, you have a lien law that there's tons of case law that says it's to be strictly construed. And, you know, if you didn't dot all your I's and cross your T's, you quite literally can, you know, lose whatever money you had into the project. And some judges are, you know, fine with that and understand it, and others do not. And it makes it very hard to predict what a court is going to do, because even if the law says, you know, that this is what the result should be, you know, you can come out of a hearing with all sorts of splitting of the baby and everything else, because I think, one, judges are, you know, some of them are trying to be fair as opposed to apply the law, which, you know, is what it is. That's a topic for a whole nother podcast. Yeah. And then I also think that there are some judges who, you know, they just don't, they're looking for an easier way to make a decision. So if they can make a decision on some procedural ground or something else, that maybe it disposes of the case, maybe it keeps it going, but it doesn't really get to the core of the issue there, which also can be frustrating for a client, because it's like, oh, we've done all this work to get to this point only to be, you know, pushed down another road by the court system or something else. And, you know, that's, again, that doesn't really jive with getting things done and getting disputes resolved.
So a client comes to you and says, what's going to happen and how much is it going to cost? I mean, as an attorney, how do you answer that question? Because, yeah, I want to know how you answer it, because I just stand and say, I don't know. Just give me your credit card. And I hate saying that, but I don't know any of this. I mean, how do you handle it?
I tell most people if it's sort of a typical, you know, and I say typical in air quotes, you know, two party, it's a contractor versus a property owner, or a contractor versus a contractor, just two people, not a, you know, general contractor names, 35 subcontractors and a huge construction defect case. But I tell them, listen, these things can last, you know, 18 months to 2 years to even longer, depending on the court system. And you need to plan to spend, you know, at least $2,000 to $3,000 a month on average. So if you're prepared to, you know, buy 3 or 4 brand new trucks and pay for them for the next 3 years, that's what I cost you, then you should pick this fight. And if you're not, then we should find other ways to resolve it. And that really brings it home for a lot of people, because everybody thinks, oh, I can pay the retainer, I can pay the $5,000 retainer or the $3,000 retainer, whatever it is, or, you know, oh, some months it'll be expensive, but most months maybe it'll only be a few $100. And what they don't realize is, you know, if you do a bunch of depositions in 1 month, that might be a $10,000 month for billing. And yeah, the first 2 months before that were only a few $100, but that's why it's $2,000 to $3,000 per month is what it averages out to. So that's how I answer it, because I think it hits home a lot easier for most people. They can wrap their mind around, like, okay, do I have a business that can cash flow that? And if so, then maybe they're willing to do it. And if not, then, you know, a lot of times we find other ways to resolve things.
Well, I agree, especially when you have no predictability, because you cannot tell. And then the other question is, because I know in my experience, how many clients have ever really been made whole by the litigation process? In your experience?
None. Even if you get every dime that you're owed by the customer, you've still paid me. And at best, you're going to get about 90% of my fees from a judge. And all of this is assuming the person on the other side can stroke you a check for it.
Exactly. At the end of the day, that it's all collectible. And right. It's just ridiculous to me that, you know, let's rush to the courthouse, let's rush to trial, because at the end of the day, honestly, the only people that get paid are the lawyers, right?
Yeah.
We get paid to do that, but we're doing you a disservice if we don't show you all the ways to settle the dispute before you get there. Because although it's not ideal, the alternative, because not only are you paying me, how much time do you have to spend away from your business producing every single document you can ever imagine that never even related to this case? It may not even be used, but you got to produce it, and just, you know, your deposition's taken, and you got to be there to take other people's depositions. So what I always tell my clients is that before you walk into that, really think about it, because your time is really better spent putting it into your business, because you'll get something out of it there. Here, all I can say is, yeah, you probably are not going to break even, and it's going to take a lot of your time.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, if you get sued, you don't have a choice. But if you're the one who's going to bring it, you can really think about it. So what, in your experience, are some ways to get around that? What are some other ideas besides litigation?
I mean, I always try to ask clients if there's a way that we can informally resolve it. You know, can we talk to the other side? Do you want to see if everybody's willing to split the cost of a mediation? For most of the construction contracts I draft for my clients, I put a pre-suit mediation requirement in there. Because even if you don't resolve it, it helps, it forces the other side to show some of their cards early on. And a lot of times that's the first time my clients have ever had to really hear what the other side thinks is an issue, and it can drastically change how, you know, quickly or ready, you know, they are to jump into litigation if they see, like, oh wow, this actually could be a fight, there could be some issues here. So I've tried to do that, because, and I've actually had a decent success rate. I'd say maybe a third or so of the cases have settled at mediation, usually some sort of a walk away, because everybody realizes, wow, this is going to be expensive and time consuming for all of us. We should move along. So that's the biggest thing that I've found to be successful. And if you put it in a contract, then the parties have to do it, or you can at least get if somebody sues you, you can get a court to compel mediation and stay the litigation. So again, you have that opportunity to do that before everybody has spent, you know, $1 billion on things. So that's really been the most effective thing that I've seen lately. The other thing that I have found to be really effective, and this may not seem completely, it may not make total sense, but I've started including non-disparagement clauses in my contracts for contractors as well. And yes, that makes sense, you know, so that people don't give bad reviews. But when people don't do that, or they, you know, put something up there and you show them the non-disparagement provision and they take it down, that is what honestly has incited so much litigation, because my client doesn't really care that they got stiffed $5,000. They care. They're not willing to go to war over that. But if you post a bad review and they were worried that it can cost them business, they are willing to go to war over that. And so having a non-disparagement provision has actually saved some of that, because it makes people take down stuff that they shouldn't have written.
That's a great idea.
So yeah, not obvious, but it actually has worked. So
yeah, because I have those in my settlement agreements, but I haven't thought about putting them in the actual contract agreements. But especially on the residential side, if somebody's willing to sign it, most definitely.
Yeah.
Do you ever threaten litigation to resolve a matter, even though you're really not going to, or your client really doesn't want to?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely put in demand letters or things like that we're going to sue, or we're prepared to sue. I've drafted complaints to include with letters that we were never going to file. you know, honestly, it doesn't, I don't feel like that, I don't know that that's ever made a case settle before litigation. Because
if you've been in litigation, if the other side has been in litigation before, I would think they'll think twice, you know?
Yeah, no,
I don't know. I use it as a threat.
No, they do. I try not to, put things in letters that I'm not actually going to do, because inevitably you have a client who wants to do that, and then they want to threaten something else that they're never going to do. And eventually it's like, listen, they're throwing our letters in the fire, because we're never going to follow up on any of this stuff. So,
yeah, cause there's no teeth behind them. If you don't pick your fight and actually do
right,
it.
Right. So I don't threaten litigation a whole lot unless it's actually going to happen. And this is another reason. Florida has, some pretty onerous, consumer protection laws that prohibits you from making, you know, certain types of threats. And so that's another reason I've steered away from some of it, is unless you're actually going to do it, you know, a savvy, you know, consumer protection lawyer could try to use that against you and, you know, all of a sudden you've taken a case where you thought you should win, $10,000 into something that the other side's entitled to a $1,000 statutory award plus attorney's fees. And that may just be peculiar to Florida, but that's another reason I try not to threaten stuff unless we're actually going to do it.
I guess here's a question. How backed up are your courts from COVID in Florida?
If in terms of getting an actual trial, you can't on the civil side right now. They're so backed up.
They're
doing hearings. I mean, we're doing Zoom hearings, things like that. I'm interested to hear how Texas is handling it as well. So you're getting some of that stuff. But even that is, at least a month or two out. And again, you can't get trial dates right now. So what are you guys experiencing?
Yeah, we were before COVID, we were about a year from the time you filed suit that you get your first trial setting. Now, don't be wrong, you probably get passed once or twice before you actually go. But now it's 2 years. You know, you get your docket control order that you're 2 years out. And we are handling hearings via Zoom, and we're doing bench trials. I've had a couple bench trials via Zoom that went pretty well. The jury trials are the ones that are really suffering. They tried to use the big convention center to do it, and I think, but with the governor lifting the order effective tomorrow, they're going to bring back jury trials, but I think they might require a mask. I don't know that they're back in the works. Because I have so many cases that should have gone early this spring. I have like 6 cases that are ready to go to trial. And my client's like, and I just sit, there's nothing I can do. We're all ready. There's nothing else to do. And, it's really hard to sell that to a client, which is why I've been pushing lately arbitration. I know it's way more expensive, but 6 to 9 months, I can have you to, how do you feel about arbitration?
I like it for that reason, that you can get things done a lot faster, especially right now. It is more expensive, but you also get to keep everything private. So if you're concerned about, bad stuff being said about your company, arbitration is a good way to keep all of that out of the public record. So I have been doing that, a lot more. The only thing that I don't like about arbitration really is, a judge is used to sending somebody home disappointed at the end of every hearing. And I feel like arbitrators are less used to that. And so you're much more likely to get an arbitrator who, splits the baby or does something else like that at the end of the day, rather than, maybe giving you everything you could have gotten in a court system. But that's the trade-off. You either go for slow and a little less expensive and get what you want, or, get half of it, but you can be done in 9 months.
The other thing I like about arbitration too is there's no discovery disputes. Everything comes in, right? Produce me everything. I'm going to use everything. It's all open. The arbitrator's going to decide, because so much of the funds in litigation are spent on all that process, sending the request, right, responding to the request, people objecting, just give me the stuff. And so,
right,
I'm trying to start this wave in the discovery and litigation that, hey, we're just going to give you everything I have, because, this back and forth, I'm not going to produce it because I don't think I have to, kind of just cost everybody money and time. So,
I totally agree with that. I've actually started doing the same thing. I remember my first job out of law school, being taught how to respond to discovery requests, and it was, all these objections and all this sort of stuff. And I'll object if something's really sort of outside, hey, you're not entitled to all of our bank statements,
exactly.
That's financial discovery, but you're entitled to all this other stuff. Let's just give it to you, because honestly, and here's the thing, I think that's really a function of once you've started to actually go to trial and deal with, evidence and evidentiary objections and how that matters, you really start to care a whole lot less about what gets discovered, because fine, you can discover all this stuff, you're never going to get in at trial, so I don't care.
We'll have the dispute in the courthouse when we go to trial, if it's going to happen at all. I agree, but this whole build up about what I should produce, what I should not produce, let's just be real, and I'll give you everything I got. If you're going to overreach, then we're going to have a fight. But okay, so that brings up, how do you feel and have you seen subscription pricing? Every month, no matter what you do, the client gets the same bill every month.
I have seen that. I think you just started offering it. I think I saw that. And there's another firm here by me. They're started by me. They're now, they have a bunch of offices around the country, but they do a lot of subscription stuff. Mm-hmm. as well, I think especially related to liens. I don't know that it covers any litigation or anything like that. I've talked to some of my clients about it. Like, hey, would you rather just pay X amount of dollars to me every month and, you know, not have to worry, be able to ask me things and, you know, whatever. And most of them have said, like, no, like, I'd rather just pay you when I need you. And so even if it averages out over the same price, you know, per month, that's fine. I'd rather just do it that way. I almost wonder if it's a generational thing. I'm very much, not that I'm super young, but I'm very much of the mindset, like, oh, I'd be willing to pay $10 a month for that to know that that's what the price was going to be, or $100 or $500, you know, whatever it is. I'm way more open to that. Most of my clients are probably about 15 or so years older than I am. And most of them are, or at least my main client contacts, and most of them have said, no, I just pay you as I use it. But I do wonder if it's going to become more popular as, you know, a generation or two from now that's used to, oh, everything I've bought on my phone, everything I've bought here and there, it's all sort of a subscription. I wonder if it's going to become way more commonplace that they're going to say, hey, let me have this set access to this set level of services for a certain dollar amount every month. And then the question mark always for me is, how do you handle litigation? I mean, do you handle litigation as part of your subscription?
I do. I have a subscription plan that handles basically all of plaintiff work, right? Plaintiff work for a flat fee. If you're countersued, that's an hourly rate that I discount 20%. But so, like, all of my lien clients, they come in, I have a subscription plan to handle all of their liens, bond claims, whatever. And then if they want to take the next level and go to litigation, because the biggest thing is, like, oh my God, how much is it going to cost? And, like, if you have one lawsuit, the subscription plan is not for you. But if you're a material supplier, if you're somebody else that has several lawsuits, that's going to be a fit for you. And it's going to be predictable and something you can work into your, you know, here's what my collection costs are. And really what it comes down to at the end of the day, because we can get our fees here, is I collect it back. But if you do it consistently and you do it right, you'll have less than a 1% write-off on the business that you do, if you do everything properly. And so that's kind of what I think that's where the wave of the future is. And plus, I just think it's so much more sellable, right? Especially if somebody wants to go to litigation, they've already been burned, or my competitors that bill them once a month and it's $12,000 or $13,000 a month. I offer way better service. I offer predictable pricing. And these are, you know, after I took a survey of all my clients, and, you know, one of the biggest things that is the price, right? Especially when you start litigation, it's really hot and heavy, like $6,000 or $7,000. And then people are burnt out. They're like, oh my God, what is this going to end? And you've just started, right? And I got sick having put clients that I really cared about to the curb because I couldn't afford to represent them because they couldn't afford to pay me. And that's happened several times where if they would have had this option, we could have worked together. So it's.
What do you find?
Go ahead.
I apologize. I want to pick your brain for a second on this. How do you, so again, a lot of my clients, the way I've sort of characterized them is they have a problem every like 3 years. And so it's, you know, every 3 or 4 years we're involved in a lawsuit and then nothing. You know, do you find that most of your clients fit that bill, or are most of them more like material suppliers or people who have, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 active disputes going on at one time?
I kind of run the gamut. So I offer subscription pricing, but I also offer what I call as my general retainer, which is 25. And having built my firm from the ground up, I run it differently. Okay. And it runs the way it is. So it's good for the client and what I need to survive. So I have a $2,500 retainer that I put in my IOLTA account that just stays there. And basically you can call me about any matter. Should I sign this release? Can you review the subcontract? And I have a bunch of different pricing for that. So whatever they have in the in-between. So to pick up, like, the alternative is I want to be there to help you. So you call me and I do this for you and I don't charge you, because that's just the way it is. But this way, and then after a while, you start to feel guilty for doing that. But this way, if you have that little question, I can answer it. I can review the document, get it back to you. And then every 2 weeks, I send out a bill. And I actually have a credit card on file to charge that. If your credit card doesn't go through, I'll take it from the retainer. But if there's no work, you don't get a bill. If there's work, you get a bill for the work that's done. And so I find that really helpful, because on what I'm trying to have been in the business, what we needed as a material supplier was, should I sign this release? and I need that answer now because I got to know because I need to make payroll and I need that check. And so the kind of service that the mom and pop shop needs available all the time. And so for those kind of clients, that's what I offer. And so if they get a letter in the mail, I'll respond or, you know, that kind of thing. It's just whatever it costs. And for material supplier clients are more likely to have the, you know, the subscription would make more sense because it handles all of their liens, all of their bond claims, collection phone calls, and then if they have to go to litigation, it handles the pro side. And the great thing about a material supplier, if you're suing an owner and a lien, very likely are you to have a counterclaim unless there's something wrong with materials.
Right.
So, you know, that's really the sweet spot where you want to be is that I supply the stuff. And Texas is one of the, and I've, you know, I'm reading all 50 states, and Texas is one of those states, like, if you can prove, and this is where the courts screw me up, but if you can prove that you supplied it to the subcontractor, that's it. You don't have to prove actual incorporations. Some other states require incorporation.
Wow.
Don't get me wrong. Not every judge followed that. And I've gotten my ass kicked because as a material supplier, I only had signed delivery tickets and I didn't have pictures of the shit used on the job site. But anyways, I digress. but that's kind of what I offer because I want to offer the service that I would have needed as a business owner.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's funny you talk about drawing from your own experience because my experience on the construction side, being more of a GC or even a subcontractor, I understand the appeal of a subscription plan. But I also think, well, gee, we never would have used it. Like we called our attorney, you know, once or twice a year. And so there would have been 10 months out of the year that we were paying for something we didn't use. It would have made more sense just to have a retainer call when we need and replenish as we need. So, but I completely get it for material suppliers. And I even understand it for higher volume subcontractors. I think if you've got more of a service oriented business, that, you know, the lien laws would apply to, I think it actually probably makes a ton of sense. You know, so that's, no, I like the idea.
I just think there's so much that, and I try to do, you know, here's a great example. I had a client come in the other day and he knows he needs a lawyer. He's grumpy about it. He hates that we charge. And he's like, lawyer and dentist, you're in the same place. And I said, you know what? If you got your teeth cleaned more often, you wouldn't get fillings. And that's kind of like how I feel. If you will come in and listen, hey, when I send out that email saying, hey, you really need to get an employee handbook. I have a flat fee on it. Come do it.
Right.
Otherwise, you're going to have to get a filling later on.
Right. Exactly. No, that's actually a great analogy. No, I totally agree. Yeah. Get your contract up to speed. Get your handbooks in order. Get everything else because when you need it, you will wish you'd had it for as long as you know, could have had it.
I agree. Well, thank you. I think this has been a great topic, a great discussion. And if anybody needs a construction lawyer in Florida, Jason Lambert, and he is hammerandgavel.com is where you'll find his podcast. And we'll make sure to put all that in the show notes. But this has been a very interesting conversation. And I think in the future, we'll be picking your brain on Florida lien laws. I'm trying to learn every state and you happen to be an expert there. So I will have you on the show for that. But is there anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Jason?
No, this is so much fun. I, you know, excited for you to be launching this podcast as well. So this was a great time and please anything you need, please don't hesitate to reach out. You know, look forward to talking to you again soon.
I agree. And some great advice here on how to quit getting screwed as it comes to litigation and attorney's fees. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Tune in 2 weeks from now for a new episode. Thank you.